Okay. This is Nate Klarfeld.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Stonewall Live. This is Nate Klarfeld. Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. Tonight, my guest is Lev Raphael, who's written 21 books, including 7 Nick Hoffman mysteries. What's it with all the people being killed at the University of Michigan, State University of Michigan in Michiganopolis? Lev Raphael has written over decades. I'm not going to age you there. And he's written on everything from Jane Austenites to mysteries to his own memoirs. Lev, hello. How are you doing?
Hey, it's great to be there in spirit anyway. I know it's warmer than it is up here.
Yeah, it's perfect weather here. We're not going to talk about that. Okay, we never talk about that. First of all, welcome. I've been dying to talk to you for many, many years. We're going to talk about the Nick Hoffman mysteries and the two books that have been recently re-released on ebook, Little Miss Evil and Death of a Constant Lover, two of my favorite Nick Hoffman mysteries. But first, I want to ask you, how did you get started writing?
Oh God, I've been writing since I was in second grade. I started writing fiction in second grade, and because I fell in love with storytelling and I wanted to tell my own stories, and so I got to live my dream. I mean, you know, people pay me to tell my stories.
Really, they are. That's great. What a job. One of your early books was a collection of short stories called Dancing on Tisha B'Av. I don't know how old that is. You probably can tell me in 2 seconds. And I've got that on my bookshelf in my den. It's one of my favorite books. I reread it all the time. There's some wonderful short stories in there, especially for Jewish and gay, but not even just being gay and coming out. And last week I had a fundraiser at my house. My partner and I are active in the Democratic Party, and a gentleman walked up and said, "I've never read that book. I've heard it was very good." And of course I pulled it off the shelf and handed it to him because I've got more than one copy because I'm part of the Stonewall Library and Archives in Fort Lauderdale. And he's called me 3 times, thanking me a million times. That book has had a big impact. Have you had any of that feedback?
Oh, yeah. I've been amazed at the impact it had. So when I was on a book tour in Austria, someone told me that he started a gay Jewish group in Vienna after reading that book. Mm-hmm. People have told me it's helped them come out to their rabbis. One person told me she went through 7 copies. It's the kind of thing that you can't believe actually happens when you're a writer, that a book means that much to people. Because all of them mean a lot to you as an author. But when you get that kind of feedback, it's deeply moving and humbling, because, you know, somehow saying thank you isn't enough. But then saying, "Can I take you out to dinner?" seems too much.
Let me clarify something for the listeners. Dancing on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a Jewish holiday that commemorates the destruction of the Second Temple. It's a very sad holiday. You're not allowed to dance, cut your hair, get married. I don't know, there's probably 15 other rules I'm overlooking. So the fact that the name of the book is Dancing on Tisha B'Av, which is also the title, I believe, of one of the short stories, is kind of like not sacrilegious, but kind of like an in-your-face, poke-you-in-the-eye title.
Well, it's breaking a taboo, and that's what the book itself did, because nobody until that point, no male gay writer had brought together Jewish themes and gay themes so openly and so provocatively. This is what reviewers said. But it's not the only time I've broken a taboo. My memoir, My Germany, is about coming to terms with Germany as the son of Holocaust survivors, and that is something that's very hard for a lot of American Jews to handle.
We'll talk about the My Germany thing in a few minutes, but let me go back to my the fun part of tonight, which is of course your favorite part, the Nick Hoffman mysteries. How's Nick doing?
He's doing well. He is biding his time. He is watching Occupy Wall Street and contemplating another foray into the world of criminal detection. I wait for him to come to me. I mean, each time I've written one of the books, it's because I heard his voice in my head, either when I was walking the dog or swimming or whatever. I heard him starting to tell me a story. I mean, obviously, he's not independent of me, but his voice works inside me, and when it's ready, you know, I write the book. So he's getting ready for another book, I think.
Oh, good, good. How long has Nick been with you? How long have you been writing Nick Hoffman mysteries?
Since the mid-90s, and one of the things I wanted to do was to have a mystery in which there was a happily married gay couple, and that was kind of the groundwork that was taken for granted, and also two nice Jewish boys, let's put it that way, and surprisingly, the most frequent group of readers who comment about the relationship between Nick and Stefan in the series is not gay, but it's straight people who tell me that either the relationship taught them something, or it, you know, gave them courage to ask someone they knew, "Are you gay? And you were afraid to tell me," or it had an impact on them, and that's wonderful. Again, it's one of those things that you can't predict. That a writer's career is totally unpredictable, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but this is all good.
Oh, it's fabulous, actually. You were one of the first writers. You said mid-90s. I've been involved with gay literature for quite a while. I'm with the Stonewall Library and Archives here in Fort Lauderdale. It's now called the Stonewall National Museum, but it's a long story. Anyway, you were one of the first writers to go into phase three of gay literature. Phase one of gay literature, of course, was the coming out, the secrets, the angst, the rejection, the suicides, the dead gay person at the end of every novel. Phase two of gay literature was AIDS. AIDS smacked us in. There were a lot of books about AIDS. And then phase three is the fun part, is where there's just wonderful novels, wonderful descriptive novels who just happen to have characters who are gay. And they might as well have been Swedish or, you know, from Antarctica, but you made them gay and you made them totally part of a wallpaper. Nick and Stefan are just there, you know. They do things that are unique to gay couples, but they're just there. Am I getting that right?
Oh yeah, but I also like playing with that, because there's one character in the series, a wild, foul-mouthed sort of Bette Midler type who keeps harassing Nick because she thinks he's actually too straight. She thinks because he's gay, he should have a really wild and kinky sex life and do all kinds of untoward things. And he says, you know, "I'm married. I'm really not that interesting," or not as interesting as she would like him to be. That's one of the things I like to do in the series, is play with some stereotypes, just like I made her a Canadian and a professor of Canadian literature, and turned her into like a total diva and a drama queen, which is not your typical image of what Canadians are like,
or professors.
Or professors. And, you know, at one point Nick was feeling threatened in the series and he went shopping for a gun. And instead of doing, you know, a typical gun shop with the guys in camouflage pants and stuff, I did a gun boutique that was, you know, in an upscale neighborhood. Yeah, and that was a lot of fun. So, you know, playing with what readers expect is always fun in the mystery series. But you have to give them, you know, a good mystery and hopefully a corpse or two.
Or two, yes. How's Nick changed over the years? Do you think Nick has changed over the years?
Oh yeah, I've definitely. One of the things I reviewed mysteries and thrillers for the Detroit Free Press for over a decade, or about a decade, and one of the things that used to bother me as a reader was when people would encounter a body or have a brush with death, and they'd, you know, go out to Denny's for eggs and hash browns, you know, half an hour later, as if nothing had really affected them. And what I have tried to do over the course of the 7 books is show how Nick has changed, has gotten somewhat more serious, a little darker in his vision, even though he's still a funny guy, I hope, and that he's, you know, he's trying to figure out how he wound up in this at this Bucala campus and keeps getting involved in murder.
Yeah, right. Back to the campus thing. You kind of peel back the veneer, the ivy and granite veneer of beautiful campuses, and show the seedy, jealous, murderous world of academia, which most of us don't even know existed, never knew existed. I mean, I went to college, I've got a couple of degrees, I love my professors, I hated my professors, but I never knew there was jealousy, revenge, pettiness, boredom. I assumed that it was all just kind of, that was the epitome of life, to just sit around and be in academia with tenure all your life. And you showed us a different world, didn't you?
Well, I have to tell you, I've done hundreds of talks and readings around the country and in Canada and elsewhere, and anytime I speak at a college campus of any kind, whether it's a community college or an Ivy League school, people who know that I do the series tell me these hair-raising stories about stuff that's going on under the surface at their campuses, or sometimes just right out in the open. And sometimes I think you cannot make this stuff up. And sometimes I say, well, you should write this. And I say, well, no one would believe it. I've got to tone it down for it to be believable in a book.
Oh, you're kidding. I think it's pretty wild in the book.
Oh yeah, it's. I just get these hilarious stories, and so, you know, basically the thing with professors is they're bald men arguing over a comb.
Right.
The intensity of the jealousy is in direct proportion to the size of the prize, which usually isn't very big. Sometimes
right.
it's a corner office. I mean, you know, the things,
right.
but. Again, it's satire, and the thing I found in my own academic career is that, you know, it's a great target for satire because it just hands itself to you. You do not have to hunt for material. The material hunts you.
That's amazing because, as I said, I'm an outsider. I was never, you know, on the other side of it teaching. I was never a graduate student. You know, I went straight through school. I adored professors or I hated them, but I never thought of there being this seamy, ugly, jealous, revengeful, yucky side, and your book paints it, and you laugh. I mean, it actually is the funniest parts of all of your books. It's when you go over what goes on with the offices and who hasn't published, and you know how much they make and the salaries. I never even thought of that, but that is a big part of the book, and they are funny, and it's a wonderful behind the scenes stuff, and it makes it much more interesting, and I love it. So,
well,
okay.
You know, that is why people read mysteries, is why, not just for the murder and the puzzle, but they want to find a world that they don't know, whether it's a college campus or it's Sweden.
right. I brought up Sweden earlier. You have a wonderful quote in Death of a Constant Lover. I think that's the one I picked it up out of. I've been reading your books for like, you know, a month since we started this, and because I've got them all over the house. And the quote is, education had long stopped being a privilege at State University of Michigan and the country at large. It was nothing more than a business transaction and often a ripoff. Now, that was written quite a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, but I think it's gotten
it's more true
more.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think people have unrealistic expectations of what they're going to get, and they're, you know, they're not treated as well as they should be, and the whole atmosphere is just getting weirder and weirder. So but that's actually one reason why I took a little time off of the series, not just to write some other things, but I just wanted to think about all of this some more and reflect on it, and then see what Nick had to say.
Yeah, it is kind of it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, and I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, getting the student loans, getting the money, raising tuitions, raising the student loans, getting tuitions, getting, you know, getting the student loans, getting tuitions, and they just seem to fill up the place, and that's all they're interested in is filling up the seats.
Well, and in fact, I'm glad you mentioned the word seats, because in some schools they talk about the chairs. I mean, the students
right.
have chairs, you know, that's how they're figuring it. And in other schools, all that counts is the football team or the basketball
right.
team or whichever
exactly.
team is doing really well and bringing in alumni bucks. So it's a great environment for murder as a writer, because as a sociologist at Oxford, I heard say, academics don't have very good means for conflict resolution.
No, they don't. You're right. They probably don't. I'm going to go ahead and give the call-in number if you want to talk to the host or our guest, Lev Raphael. Our number is 805-830-8355. It should be up on your board while you're watching, listening to the show. I always say watching, but you're listening to the show. 805-830-8355. We'll just keep talking. Okay. So you mentioned My Germany, which was a son of Holocaust survivors coming to terms with Germany. Here's a big confession. I'm also the son of two Holocaust survivors. And I have been back to Germany and Poland and visited the camps. I can't imagine writing my thoughts down. I kept a diary. My diary's owned to myself. What was the motivation behind My Germany?
Well, I found myself on a train, you know, a beautiful German train, headed into a city where I was going to do a talk. And this was the same city that 60-odd years before my mother had entered on as a concentration camp internee on a cattle car, you know, with nothing, no food, no water, no toilet. It just hit me, the contrast between me coming in as a successful American author 60-odd years after she had entered the same city in a completely different way was so mind-blowing. The book just was born out of that, and that's where it starts, with me on the train thinking about her life, my life. And that's what I did with the book, was talk about my parents' experiences with Germany, their lives growing up, my life growing up in the shadow of what had happened to them and what Germany meant to me, and then what it was actually like to go to Germany. And here's another thing. I've now been there 5 times. I've done 4 book tours there. I never thought that would happen.
And you just came back from book tour recently from...
Yes, I was there for about 2 weeks, yeah, and I did about 7 or 8 readings. I did a couple of them in German, which was quite an experience, and I did that last year too.
Really, that's fascinating. Tell I mean, what's it like to do book tours in other countries?
Well, I'll tell you, in Germany, they treat authors incredibly well. I mean,
uh-huh.
you're not just somebody appearing at Barnes & Noble, you know,
right.
one of 600 authors that year. You're treated with respect as kind of a cultural figure, as an artist. And people are very solicitous. Very interested in hearing what you have to say. That doesn't mean they believe, you know, that they agree with everything you say, but and they couldn't have been friendlier. I mean, the last time, one of my tours, I just got presents everywhere I went. Wine,
wow.
chocolates, books, calendars, DVDs. I mean, I got so much stuff I had to stop twice at DHL and send a box home because I couldn't
wow.
fit all this stuff in my luggage. So they're very it's a book culture. Okay, that's
right.
what's so different. I mean, this culture isn't over there is not focused on TV or movies the way we are. They're focused on books, and
right.
so being an author places you at a different place in that culture than it does here. So touring there is great. I mean, I'd go back in a shot. I think it's
right.
it's wonderful. It's exhausting, but it's wonderful, and and it's fun to see your career from a different country's perspective.
That's amazing. And you're one of the few American authors that do that. I mean, most of the authors I speak with you know, some of them don't leave the Eastern Seaboard. You know, if they were, you know, if they were told to go to Kansas City, they wouldn't do it.
Well,
you're laughing.
I won't open up a new supermarket, but I've been all over the country, in Canada and Western Europe and Israel. You know, I'm curious to read and speak to other audiences and hear what they have to say and see what their reactions are. It is a trip, I have to tell you, speaking German in Germany and actually reading from my book in German, because people stare at me like they can't believe an American would
German.
Even tackle their language. Yeah.
Right.
And the funniest thing anyone said last year, someone came up to me after one of my readings in German, and he looked at me a minute and he said, "I was expecting an accent, and I did not hear it." And then he walked off. I said, "Well, that's an interesting compliment. Thank you very much."
Yeah, my partner, who is a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Texan with a southern drawl, lived in Germany. Went to college there. He's a psychiatrist, and he's a really formally trained Freudian psychiatrist. And so we went back to Germany a few years ago, and he picked up his German right away without any accent and stuff like that. But then he would switch into his southern Texas drawl, which just people would stare at him like, "What are you doing?" You know, but it was interesting. I do agree with you up at the friendliness and the book culture, that it is an amazing change of pleasant, actually, to go to a country that you didn't expect to enjoy, and all of a sudden you really find yourself very much at home, very much easy to speak with people. And I speak Yiddish, but I don't speak German, so I understood them, but I couldn't speak it. Yiddish was my first language, by the way, so it's kind of I don't speak English with an accent. So, well, anyway, let me go on to. I'm just kidding. Let me go on to Rosedale and Love and The Jewess and the Gentile. Those are my little Christmas gifts for all my in-law outlaw friends this weekend, this year for Hanukkah, Christmas. I loved those books, but I'm a Jane Austenite. Explain how you started that whole genre.
Well, I did The Jewess and the Gentile, Pride and Prejudice, The Jewess and the Gentile, because I was really fascinated by the Austen mashup craze. And I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and it really got me thinking. You know, I felt like the books that you know, throw zombies into Austen's universe are kind of like, you know, breaking into someone's house, trashing it, breaking all the dishes, you know, spray painting graffiti all over, and then leaving. Kind of interesting, kind of exciting. I wanted to do something completely different. I wanted to pick the lock of Austen's door, walk into her house, and rearrange the furniture, and then leave without any other trace of my having been there. So what I did was I wove this Jewish theme into the into Pride and Prejudice, and I made the Bennett family Anglo-Jews, and kind of worked out all the different complications and changes that would arise from that. And you know, it was kind of like a love letter to Jane Austen. And Rosedale and Love is set in 1905 in New York, which was crazier and richer than in New York even is today, and certainly more showy.
Right.
And it's my version of Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth. I wanted to write a response to how she treated her Jewish character, which was not very well. And I thought, I'm going to write a whole book about this guy. And I did. And that was a lot of fun. So I never expected to do either one of those. And then when the ideas came to me, I thought, well, that's what I want to do. So now I'm kind of playing around with other ideas for historical novels.
They're great. They're so much fun to read. And if you are a literature buff like I am, Rosedale and Love and Pride and Prejudice, The Jewess and the Gentile are wonderful reads. They're all available on ebook and Kindle. We're going to do a little commercial here, as are the two new re-released books. I guess they're re-released, The Death of a Constant Lover and Little Miss Evil. How has the ebook
and the historicals are on sale for December.
Oh, the historicals are on sale. I didn't know that. So now we're
Yeah, that just happened today. Yep.
Oh.
Yep. They're only $3.99, and I think if I sell another 7 books, I can buy that toaster that I've longed for. A really classy 4 slice.
Chrome one. So how has that changed things? How has e-reading and the new publishing world, how has that changed your life at all? Does it affect you at all?
Oh, it affects every writer I know tremendously. What it raises for me is the question: for any book that I published 19 traditionally, I went to ebook directly for 2. When you publish your own ebook and you have your own editor and copy editor and cover artist and everything else, and a team working on putting it out there, you have total control, which is something
right.
that authors are not used to, and that really makes a difference. What the ebook revolution has done is give authors a choice. Do you want to go the traditional route, or do you want to put it up there yourself with all the assistance you can muster? And then you have to ask yourself, well, what do I gain doing it one way? What do I gain doing it the other? So, authers often hadn't had choice until now.
Correct.
I think it's a real gift for those of us who have a long track record.
Right. And also what a lot of people that aren't in the literature world, business world don't know is that once a publisher accepts your book and publishes it, you think you're done. No, that's your beginning. They don't market it. You have to do your own marketing. You have to do your own footwork. You have to do your own publicity anyway. So why not just do it as an ebook with yourself, with your own little team? It's a lot harder, but you've got to get out there and stump anyway. So might as well do it for yourself.
Yep, I agree. Authors make much more money per copy than if they put the book up themselves. I know some people who are actually making a living just off of their ebooks, and so I think, it gives authors choice. I think that's what's wonderful, and I think it gives readers more choice too, and that's what's really important.
Well, yeah, because you removed a layer. You removed a layer of oh, this won't sell. This has to sell. In order for me to publish this and send it out to every Barnes & Noble and every little bookstore or every Walmart or whatever, I've got to make a million copies. I've got to make this amount of money. Whereas an ebook, there isn't that overhead.
Well, there isn't, right, there's not that much that goes in at the beginning, but also ebooks have a very different pattern of sales. With a new hardcover, for instance, if it's not selling in the first 6 weeks, couple months, publishers, bookstores, they're not happy. But an ebook can sometimes take 6 or 9 months before it really starts to build. And mm-hmm. so you have to wait longer. But then it's always there.
Right.
Well, until a meteor hits the planet, right, in which case
right.
I don't think we'll be worrying about what we read.
Yeah. And your server, and hopefully your server will be safe from hackers.
Yep, I guess that is something we all worry about.
We do. I don't worry about it, but you should worry about it since you've got 2 books that are just on e-books. When I speak to authors and more of them are getting into self-publishing even on their print books, and many of them are going to e-book directly and doing their own marketing through blogs, through word of mouth, through social media. Do you use social media at all?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I never got into MySpace. It wasn't. I just didn't connect to it. But I'm on Facebook and Twitter every day. And lots of great connections come to me through Facebook. Interviews, invitations. If people want to get a hold of me, basically right now, this is what they do. Nobody looks you up in a phone book.
I found you on Facebook.
They look for me on Facebook, or they go to my website, levraphael.com, and contact me through the email there. Those are the 2 ways that people look for authors. And that's what I do. If I'm looking for someone, I either look for their website or I see if they're on Facebook.
Exactly. We have 1 minute left. I told you it'd be the fastest 30 minutes of your life. What words would you give to a young author today? What words of advice, golden words of advice, would you give to a young author today?
Stick with it. Be determined. Don't let people grind you down by their negativity. You are in it for the long haul. A writing career is not a sprint. It is a marathon.
Very good. Great. That's just super. Well, this is about all the time we have. LevRaphael.com, LevRaphael.com is where you can find synopsis of the books and even order them. You can also find them on Facebook now that we all know that. And that's about it. And good night from Fort Lauderdale. Good night, Lev.
Yes, good night from Michigan. Take care. It was great talking to you.
Same here. Take care. Good night.
Bye.